This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Real Madrid win the Spanish Super Cup in Saudi Arabia. Where else? Back in Spain itself, Betis Sevilla's played over 2 days because someone threw a makeshift javelin at a player. Why not? In Serie A, could a ref have cost Milan the title if only he'd played advantage? Hopefully we'll learn the Italian, for it'll all even itself out over the course of the season. Is Vlahovic on his way from Fiorentina? If so, he signs off with a lovely goal. In Germany, more records for Bayern and Lewandowski. In France, PSG are 11 points clear. Elsewhere, slightly odd FIFA teams of the year, presided over by a smiling Gianni Infantino. And guess what? He's moved to Qatar. I wonder if Philippe has anything to say about that. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today. Bonjour, ça va, Philippe Auclair?
Ça va bien, merci, Max. Et toi?
Yes, thank you. Sid Lowe, hello.
Hi, Max.
Mark Langdon from the Racing Post, welcome.
Hello, Max.
And Nikki Bandini, rounding off an A-list Europod here. Hey, Nikki.
Hi, Max. How are you?
I am marvellous. Thanks very much. Let's start then with the Spanish Super Cup, because Sid has to go. He always books his train when he finds out when
I do it.
Recording.
I do it deliberately.
It's clever.
I know you do. I know you do, Sid.
I wait for you to tell me that you need me on and go, right, what's the best time to get Rushton?
And then you say, I've got to be quick. And then your first answer is 25 minutes long.
Actually, anyway. This does occasionally happen with a footballer. You know, you get a footballer interview and they go, you know, the classic thing where a club says you can only have 10 minutes. And you ask the first question and 7 minutes have gone. You go, I don't believe it. That was just the warm-up. Now we're screwed.
Right, let's start with the Spanish Super Cup then. 12th time Real Madrid have won it, which is one short of Barca's record tally of 13. First trophy under Ancelotti's current reign. The game took place in Saudi Arabia. Can you remind people who aren't Spanish football followers what the Spanish Super Cup is and what it was doing in Saudi Arabia and how people generally felt about it being there?
The Spanish Super Cup is the English Charity Shield. It's the league winners against the cup winners, only it's not anymore because the federation has come up with a new format, which is a final four. So they take the league winners and the cup winners and two other clubs. And the criteria for that seems to shift a little bit to try and guarantee that they get Madrid and Barcelona in it. They then play, obviously, a semi-final and a final, and that's what happens. It's been in Saudi Arabia, in theory, for 3 seasons, but the middle of those three was played in Spain because of the pandemic. They played in Seville last year. The reason they went to Saudi Arabia, very obviously, is money. And it's a deal which, I must confess, I can't remember. I think it runs to 2029. A deal with the Saudis to keep it there till 2029. And the reaction, I think, in the first season was, I wouldn't go so far as to say it was big, but it was sort of, people were against it. People didn't particularly like the idea of it. The second season obviously was played in Spain. The third season, because it's kind of already happened, it sort of wasn't really talked about until we got closer to the event. And then there was a little bit of commentary, but it kind of drifted away. And I suppose that's kind of the point of these things, isn't it? In the first year, there's a lot of noise. And then over a period of time, it kind of becomes normalised. And then just becomes a thing that everybody gets on with. But the comment, you know, there is still a degree of commentary around it, but not a huge amount.
Yeah, Sid, was it the idea, was it Rubiales or was it Tebas or who had this? It was the league or the FA? Because, I mean, it's bringing a lot of money in. I mean, it's hundreds of millions of euros, isn't it? Something like
that. It's worth making that point because, obviously, there is a blanket assumption sometimes when things happen. It goes, oh, look at Spanish League doing it again. No, this is the Federation, as you say. This is Rubiales at the Federation, not the league. And one of the reasons why that's significant is because the Spanish League and the Spanish Federation cannot stand the sight of each other and the presidents hate each other. And so it would be particularly unfair to load the blame of this onto an institution that absolutely hates the one that's actually done it.
The game itself, a classic Modric finish. Is he slowing down at all, Luka Modric?
I don't think so. He might even be getting faster. he's brilliant. He really, I mean, look, I know that's stating the bleeding obvious and everyone knows it, but he really is brilliant. There's a moment where the camera catches him talking to Andrei Lunin, who's the Oviedo. He was at Oviedo, which is why it was in my mind. He's the Real Madrid substitute goalkeeper. And he turns to him and says something like, you know, how long are you going to go on for? And Modric says, 40. And you know what? I'm starting to think that might be possible. About 18 months ago, genuinely, there was a really quite significant decline in Modric's performances. But for the last, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 months, he's been fantastic.
Militao was sent off for blocking a shot, one of those handballs that seemed, I don't know if it was harsh or not, a red card.
Yeah.
Very close to it.
It was a game of three red cards because you, handballs rather. You get Alaba doing a handball in the first half, which isn't given as a penalty because his hand is on the floor. And when the hand is on the floor of a player going down, they say that's not a handball, which to be honest, I think is conceptually all wrong. But, you know, that's another issue for another day, I suppose. There's the handball for the penalty that Benzema scores. And then there's the handball that gives Atletico a penalty with 5 minutes to go. Courtois makes an unbelievable save, goes the wrong way and manages to kind of flick up his left foot to save it. And as you say, a red card. I suppose it's not a big deal because it was late and it changed nothing. But yeah, it does seem a bit harsh to me to be sent off for handball, which by definition isn't deliberate.
Copa del Rey, Betis, Sevilla, over 2 days. It was it was madness, wasn't it? I saw you getting pretty irate on social media about it.
Irate social media? Surely not.
That's what it's there for. Were you there?
No, I wasn't. No.
Right.
No.
But it was, I mean, the weird thing about it was that a Betis fan threw it at a Sevilla player. That's not the weird thing. But after Betis has scored, it wasn't thrown in anger. It was sort of thrown in happiness. Straight. I mean,
well,
apart from Steve Backley, who throws a javelin in happiness? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder, actually, now that the police believe that they found the guy that did it, they actually arrested someone who it turned out wasn't the person. They've now arrested someone else. I wonder if that may actually be the defence. You know, he threw it up in the air in a state of joy and it accidentally flew through the air and hit Jordan out on the head. That's not particularly plausible, but I wonder if it might be the defence that's used. I mean, there are so many ways of handling this and so much happened after it that I sort of don't know where to start, to be honest with you, Max, except obviously to start with a fundamental thing, which is the person who did it is a bloody idiot and has basically ruined it for everybody else. And I know that makes me sound like a teacher saying that, but that is sort of the starting point. And that has to be, I guess, the focus of everything. The thing is that in terms of how it then played out, there's so much more that, you know, I kind of don't know where to go with it. Because, for example, let me try and go through it. So you get, this is, as you say, Betis have just scored. It's a brilliant goal from Fekir, direct from a corner. And I'm absolutely sure it's deliberate.
Yeah, because the keeper's out a little bit, isn't he?
Yeah, it's a completely brilliant goal. Everyone's celebrating. The Sevilla players are not confronting the fans or anything. So it's not the result of a confrontation. They're walking back towards the centre circle. This stick comes over, which I think is a plastic flagpole. It is plastic, by the way, not metal. I saw a few places say it was metal, but it is plastic. Which I think is important in terms of that question about how on earth did this get in the ground? Well, it got in the ground because it's a flagpole and fans have flags. Obviously, that may be something now that people start to wonder if they should change. It hits Gian Jordan on the head. He kind of goes to ground. He gets up again. There is some conversations, obviously. At one point, he makes a gesture to the fans, which is a kind of a slapping the face, sort of you're shameless, you're out of order. There's some conversations on the touchline. He then sits down again and gets looked at by the doctors. Betis's players accuse the Sevilla manager, Julen Lopetegui, of telling him to be dizzy and go to ground, you know, to maybe try and make the most of this. There's some confrontations, either directly or indirectly, as a result of that, as a result of this lack of trust, if you like. The two teams are taken down the tunnel, although some Betis players stay on the bench. In the dressing rooms, there's conversations with the referee. Eventually, the game is postponed. They come back the following day at 4 o'clock and play behind closed doors. Important point here, they play without Gian Jordan, who's been taken to hospital for observation and is back at home the following day and can't play. So there's a lot to kind of go pick your way through. And it really hasn't reflected particularly well on anyone.
I mean, it's important. People who don't know that it's a fiery derby, that one, isn't it?
And of course, that's one of the things. And that's one of the things that makes it great. And then you get this. And this is why I kind of come back to the idea of it being one idiot. And because there's a bit of me that I realise this is a bit of a cop-out. And I actually don't have the answer in terms of what should you do in a scenario like this. But I'm struggling to think of any environment in which one idiot in 55,000 means that everybody gets punished for it. Now, I don't know the answer because, of course, there has to be a way of a deterrent, of clubs being punished for the behaviour of their fans. That's always been the case. But it is just one person. And, you know, sort of you like to think that the people around them would be dobbing them in. You'd like to think that people around them would be rejecting them. There was a degree, I think, of some parts of the ground having a go at that end where Betis's more radical fans are. I don't have the answer. But there's bits of it that don't feel quite right to me.
Sure. While we're on Seville, can they mount a title challenge?
Well, they play tomorrow night against Valencia. If they win that, they would be 2 points behind Real Madrid. They are the only team that could mount a title challenge. They have...
So what, five points behind with the game in hand on Real Madrid.
Exactly. They, I believe, I haven't actually looked at the table for a couple of days. I've totally lost track.
I'm here to help, Sid. Whenever you need a La Liga table, just give me a call.
Please do, yeah. They have got through the last couple of months with loads of injuries, lots of COVID problems, not always playing very well. And you sort of look at it and think, are they that good? But they keep getting these results. And it is in a time where it feels like their intention has been, we get through this. And if they are to beat Valencia on Wednesday night, which is a pretty difficult one because Valencia defensively at least will, well, defensively they're a shambles, but they'll be aggressive and they'll make life difficult for Sevilla. If they do win that and put themselves just behind Real Madrid and they can start to bring these players back, then you sort of think it's possible.
Here's a question from Daniel. Could Barca buy back Messi? Now they're back and signing players again. Ferran Torres has signed because Umtiti signed a contract extension and then had his, you know, took a wage cut.
Only if Messi now does the thing that we talked about him doing in the summer, which is to play for free. And obviously play for free you can't because there's a minimum salary in the first division, which I believe is 170-something thousand euros. Now, for those who haven't we haven't talked about this, because Barca are over their limit, they're allowed to sign at a rate of 4-1. So for every 4 euros they save, they're allowed to invest 1 euro. So in other words, if Messi comes in on the lowest salary, 170,000, they would essentially have to find 4 times that, and I'm not going to do the maths because I'll get it wrong and look like a twat. They'll have to generate 4 times that to be able to sign Messi, even if he came on a free. So it's not going to happen.
But you know, the Barca situation is as it was, it's levelling out.
There's a broader economic question. And then there's the mechanics of getting people signed because of the rules. And they are dealing with that, which is about the salary limits and about trying to generate the money to allow them to invest the money. In other words, this 4-for-1 thing. Although if you get rid of a single player that is worth more than 5% of your transfer limit, then you can do 2-for-1. So for every 2 that you save, you can spend 1. I know it's...
Sounds like a supermarket, doesn't
it? But basically, they are in a position where anything that they invest has to be preceded or followed, as was the case with Ferran Torres, by savings. So they are dealing with a big, big problem in the short term, but obviously there's a broader problem, medium and long term. But that broader problem, in theory, should be fixed up to a point because, of course, revenue is increasing now because we're coming to the end of the pandemic in terms of fans going into the grounds and so on. The salary limit next year will be higher. There will be high wage earners in theory that will move on. There might even be some transfer fees in the summer, possibly even now. I mean, they would love it to happen now, but I don't think it's very likely. So it's stabilising, but that's not the same as saying they're suddenly flush with cash. Although, as you know, what was it? 2 weeks ago, was it? Gian Laporta actually used the phrase, we're back, and made the point of saying that they could sign Haaland. Well, that's not quite fair, actually. He was asked if they could sign Haaland. And he said, anything's possible.
Before you get your train to Cadiz, Sid, just a final thought on no Barcelona Femenina players getting in the FIFA World 11. That was voted by fellow pros. What, do people just hate them because they're so good? Do you know what it is?
I don't know. I mean, look, we sort of having a go at awards has sort of almost become a self-parodying cliche now because we know that there's always this issue with the awards. And the players' awards always make me laugh because they nearly always vote according to their teammates. I remember writing a piece years ago now. You know how we get very sort of snooty. I mean, but actually, you know what? Let's not call it snooty. Let's call it what it is. We get very racist. And we say things like, oh, how can that tin pot third world country be voting for the World Player of the Year? How does a guy in, you know, name your country here, say, know anything about football? And why is he getting a vote on the FIFA best player thing? Which at that point, I think was, this is the FIFA pro, that was a FIFA player, blah, blah, blah. And I remember doing this piece and looking at the list and the 3 most ridiculous votes offered by anyone, were offered by England captain John Terry, who'd basically voted for three teammates who had had diabolically bad years to be voted for. But anyway, that's my little silly
Jesper Gronkjær, player of the year.
Exactly. I mean, it wasn't quite that bad, but it really was like, oh, come on, John, get a grip. Anyway, which is perhaps an evergreen comment, I don't know. well, sorry, I've gone off on a ridiculous tangent, and I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. You're just saying awards are stupid, is apart from, of course, the Football Supporters Association.
We always have this, apart from that, absolutely. Yeah, we always have this thing. And actually, broadly speaking, my argument is always, actually, fundamentally, they're all right. People vote. You've got to accept the vote. That's who won. People who do know have voted. That's absolutely fine. But it is true that when I was looking at the list of the women's winners this morning, it did seem a bit bizarre that you've got this Barcelona team that might genuinely, in statistical terms, and I'd love to know if this is true, be the best football team ever. There may never have been a football team that's had a season like they've just had in terms of absolutely murdering everyone who came anyone near them, anyone who was stupid enough to get on a football pitch with them. And the 11 doesn't have any of their players in, and the coach isn't their coach. And you sort of think, now there are some reasons perhaps why the coach might not be their coach, not least because of the sort of the way that collapsed immediately after they won the Champions League. But it does seem a bit odd.
All right, Sid, off you go.
Cheerio!
Sid Lowe there. He doesn't care about the pod as much as the rest of us. That's all I'll say. He's only in it for
himself. I'm still here, Max.
I know you are. Sid Lowe there, out in Spain. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start with Italy. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Serie A then. AC Milan 1, Spezia 2. I mean, Milan missed a penalty, took the lead, then lost in injury time. Nikki, not the whole story, is it?
No, not at all. Milan, who had this fantastic opportunity to go top of the table. Obviously, Inter would have had a game in hand at that point, but a chance to really sort of, I guess, ignite this title race with Inter having dropped points the weekend, are drawing against Spezia. It's a game they should have won. Let's say this. It's a game they should have won by a hatful. I mean, Rafael Leao should have scored four in the first half, probably. They were completely on top of Spezia, unsurprisingly, because they're a much better team than Spezia. But then injury time at the end of the second half, Ante Rebic gets fouled. I think it was by Bastoni. The ball ends up at the feet of Junior Messias, scores this goal from outside the area. Except the goal doesn't stand because the referee had blown his whistle for the foul by Rebic. And it was one of those completely unnecessary whistles. You could have let advantage run for a few seconds. And the referee said I was mortified. You could see right away mortified by his mistake. Genuinely like, oh God, I've stuffed up here. I've made a mess of this. And sort of almost in the moment, I felt like the Milan players actually took it in surprisingly good humour. They managed to handle it. I think it was Rebic actually was there like with his hand like, on the referee's face, but in like a gentle way, not in a sort of...
Yeah, but it was a sort of beautiful, it was a beautiful sight, wasn't it, in a way? Like it wasn't like manhandling the ref. It was like this really kind of, it was like a sort of intimate clench, I guess.
A more officious ref probably could have sent him off for that. But I think, again, the referee in that moment, who's quite mortified at his mistake, and you think, it's bad, right? It's really bad. You've cost Milan the win. Except that then they go and concede a goal and lose the game. So they don't even get the draw out of it. And then it feels a lot worse again because this game that they should have won again by a hatful, don't win it by their own mistakes, then gets taken away from them by a refereeing mistake. And then you lose it against a team that's fighting relegation when this was your chance to go top of the table ahead of your neighbours. It was a sort of huge... I think it's sort of faintly horrific moment for everyone involved, except for Spezia, of course, who got 3 points and get themselves a really important win in the relegation battle. But by all accounts, certainly what's been reported in Italy, you know, you even had a delegation of Milan players who were so sort of upset a full time. They end up outside the referee's changing room. And he there is, again, sort of really upset about his mistake, apologetic to the point that in the end, again, according to what's been reported, of course, I was not there outside the dressing room, but according to what's been reported, you have Ibrahimovic basically leaving that scene saying, oh, go on, chin up, you know, you're a young referee, you know, things are going to get better for you. Like, and that's how far this sort of scene goes. But of course, when Serra, he's, again, he is a young referee. I think he's, you know, one of these referees. So this was sort of one of his bigger breaks to get a Milan game and to sort of be moving up the ranks. He's not going to have he's not going to be having another big game for quite a while. But it's a big moment in the title race, because Inter did have this tough game against Atalanta at the weekend. They drew it, and it just felt like Milan, who started the new year so well, they had a couple of really nice wins to start the year, had this great chance to say, no, we're here, we're in this title race, we're here with you. And to have it, I don't know if you say thrown away or taken away, because it's thrown away in the sense that they should have won it again by half time. But then at the same time, even with those mistakes, they still should win this game. It is a perfectly reasonable goal that gets scored that is taken away completely by an acknowledged refereeing error. And yeah, it's a tough one, I think, for everyone to digest.
I know last season, you know, we at the start of the season, we were talking about Milan possibly mounting a title challenge and they fell away. I just wonder, when was the last time that Inter and AC Milan were, you know, it went to the wire? Like, is that a 1990s time, or has it happened more recently than that?
Gosh, going to the wire is a tough one. Of course, it was Milan who ended. So after Calciopoli, of course, Inter took over for a few years and were in charge. And then that culminates in the winning treble under Jose Mourinho. And then it's Milan who end that run. But there wasn't a down to the wire race particularly. So that was probably the last time when you had them in close competition like that as the two sort of leading lights in Italy. The last time it really went down to the wire with them, gosh, it would be going back a bit further. I can't even tell you off the top of my head when the last one was, but it's been a while. And that was really sort of, it does feel, and of course there's a lot of season left, right? A lot of things can change.
Sure.
But with Milan's next game being against Juventus, who've been playing a little bit better, there is this slight fear now that we had this opportunity to have a great title race. And Inter now might just pull away again. Inter have been the best team this season. I think Milan have been really great in large stretches. I think they're a team with so much to recommend about them. I think Stefano Pioli has done a fantastic job of bringing through young players, getting the most out of young players. I think he's a really wonderful manager. But Inter do have more depth, do have more quality in the side, and have been the best team in Italy. And the worry now is just that we won't have this last few months of the season be as dramatic. But who knows? Perhaps there's another twist coming next weekend. We'll see.
I mean, I know Roma won their last game, but I'm fascinated to talk about that Juve game where, what, they were 3-1 up with 20 minutes to go, lost 4-3, missed a penalty at 4-3. And just how did Jose take that?
I think he took it about as well as you'd expect, Max. It was... Mourinho's mode at Roma for a while now has been, every time things go wrong, throw your entire team under the bus. And
you don't say.
Yeah, I mean, it's not new, is it? The reaction to that defeat was, it's a couple of weeks ago now, but I'm paraphrasing, but effectively his response amounted to, we did so brilliantly because I got everything right to be 3-1 up, but in the end we just don't have the quality of a team like Juventus. And you know, since then we've been hearing about how his team doesn't have the transfer market resources, not just of a Juventus, we know the transfer market resources of an Atalanta or a Fiorentina, which, by the way, he spent 100 million euros in the summer is what Roma spent near on. And they've also brought in now Sergio Oliveira, admittedly on a loan with option to buy deal, who did end up winning and scoring a penalty to help them beat Cagliari at the weekend. But you can't cry poor when you are worse off in points significantly. I think it's like 8 points worse off than they were under Fonseca at the corresponding time last season. When you are 9 losses already this season, when you've lost at home to every big club, when you, in the end, no matter which way you cut it, are responsible as a manager for your team being 3-1 up and then losing their heads so badly as to give up 3 goals in 7 minutes. I think, you know, I'm going to get attacked for this, because every time you criticise Mourinho, that happens. And I think everyone sort of assumes that you've been out to get him. And I think if people actually go back and listen to what I said at the beginning of this, I will say I thought it was going to end badly. But I also really enjoy having Mourinho back in Serie A, because he's box office. He's great fun. And I think it's a shame that this is how things are going. But I... I don't know. Look, maybe he can turn it around. Yeah, I do think Oliveira is a nice signing. He played well, and maybe things will get better for them. But I think this sort of constant absolving yourself of any responsibility when your team is thrown away a game like that is extraordinary. And I think it's extraordinary that he gets away with it, honestly.
So he's found two ways to use a bus. He can park it, or he can throw his own players under it.
Let's talk about two players who celebrate in very different ways, are constantly linked with Premier League clubs, Paulo Dybala at Juve and Vlahovic at Fiorentina.
Yeah, so Vlahovic is an interesting one, always interesting. He's obviously a brilliant footballer. I'm a huge Vlahovic believer in terms of his talent. I think he's an extraordinary technical talent. I also think he's one of those players you look at and think you've got the right attitude to do this. Like, he's been such a hard worker at Fiorentina. He's improved his game in so many different ways. And I think I really sort of think he's someone who's going to go far ongoing in his career. And I would have said, even as recently as yesterday, I would have said, I don't see this transfer happening this January. I think he wants to stay at Fiorentina. I think he wants to get to the end of the season. There's this sense that they could even get into Europe, maybe even the top four. I think it's a push, but that's been talked about. And I think he wants to see that journey through and then make his move in the summer. But they won 6-0 against Genoa last night, and he missed a penalty and held his hands up afterwards. But then after scoring, he did this extraordinary celebration, a brilliant goal, by the way, absolutely outrageous control and finish, and beautiful pass as well. The whole move was wonderful. But he did this celebration where he sort of held his hands up in a mostly empty stadium because Serie A has been reducing attendances again because of COVID. But he held his hands up in this sort of apologetic, slightly sort of, it felt like a farewell gesture. That's what it felt like to look at. Now, he didn't say that. He didn't say this is a farewell gesture. He hasn't said he's leaving. The manager said he's here right now. We don't know what the future holds. There have been noises coming out of the Fiorentina camp that, no, we think we can keep hold of him until the end of the season still. There's been plenty of noise that his agent's fees are just too much right now, what they're asking for, and clubs are shying away from it. But as a visual moment, looking at that way that Vlahovic responded to scoring. Fiorentina don't play at home again until February now because there's an away game, then there's the international break. I'm looking at that the same as everyone and thinking to myself, that looks like something that you do when you think you might not be back.
I suppose, Nikki, there was a suggestion that he was sort of apologising for the penalty. He sort of fluffed Panenka as well. But just, everybody talks about Vlahovic's his strengths. I just have a question about maybe some of his weaknesses and whether there is a question mark around paying 70 million euros for somebody that, you know, has only scored international goals. I know he's young, but he's only scored international goals mainly against very weak opposition. Hasn't played sort of European football. I think he's maybe played one game in European competition, but nothing really in the Champions League. Are you absolutely convinced that sort of if he did make that sort of next step, he would, say, flourish for, I mean, he's been linked with Arsenal and Tottenham particularly. Do you think he will flourish at sort of that next level?
I think it's a valid question. I think when you look at his record, I think it's absolutely comparable with the best young players in Europe, your Haalands and your Mbappes, until you get to the fact that he hasn't played in Europe. And that's a pretty big omission, right? Like, where is your European track record? Obviously, a year or two behind those players, I should say, but comparable to the sort of trajectories they've been on. I mean, he scored last year, 2021, as a calendar year. He scored the joint record for most goals in a calendar year in Serie A, matching what Ronaldo did. So he really is scoring at an extraordinary rate. And I think you can look at that, and then you also look at the eye test, don't you? And he's not another footballer. He's not Krzysztof Piątek when Piątek was scoring goals for Genoa. He is a technically superior player. He does things with the ball that most people can't do. And then for me, you combine that with what you hear him say and also what you hear his coaches say, that this is someone who does put the extra hours in, who has taken details that he's been given in what coaches see that they want him to improve in his game and worked on those relentlessly until he got better at them. I think really specific stuff you've heard from at Italiano this season about particular runs he wanted him to make, and then he's made those runs and you see him score the goal and run and celebrate with Italiano and you go, right, this is a kid who wants to listen and wants to get better. I think he's got all the elements, but of course you're right, until you've done it as Haaland and Mbappe have now in the Champions League, in a World Cup, that there's always going to be that sort of, I guess, validity of question. I think the international one's a bit of a red herring, because international football is always, first of all, such a small sample size, and secondly, he hasn't been playing for Serbia long enough to have played those big games, and they haven't been in a sort of big pile of great games like that. So I think give him time on that front, but for sure, we all need to see him in Europe.
Obviously, there's a danger if he does go to Arsenal, that Arsenal might have to play a football match, and they don't want that. And so that's a... So I'm only kidding, Philippe. Some Arsenal.
Yeah. Tottenham agenda on the podcast.
What about Paulo Dybala?
Yeah, so Paulo Dybala also scoring and getting talked about for his celebration this week, scoring goal against Udinese, and after scoring, sort of giving this very pointed, deliberate stare up at the stands, which he explained afterwards by saying he was just looking for a friend. And you think to yourself, God, I wouldn't want to be a friend if you look at me like that. meanwhile, cameras cut to Nedved sat, Juventus director, of course, sat in the area where Dybala's looking at. And he looks like he's trying to hide. It was a very sort of bizarre moment. I mean, of course, maybe he really wasn't looking at Nedved in that moment. Who knows? But
I mean, Hide and Seek with Pavel Nedved is a TV show I would watch. For sure.
The story here is that Juventus, if essentially had got... Dybala's out of contract this summer. So Vlahovic is out of contract 2023. Dybala's out of contract this summer. Juventus had sort of verbal agreement with him on this contract in October and basically don't want to give him that contract anymore. The contract would have been for 8 million a year plus another 2 in bonuses. That's after tax. It gets complicated when we try to convert that into English understanding. But anyway, it's a big contract. He'd, you know, be a highest paid player at Juventus on that deal, I think. And he, maybe not highest, there might be, well, he'd be up there anyway. He'd be one of the highest paid players in Serie A on that deal. And the issue you've got with Dybala at this age is, on the one hand, he is one of, I would say at this point, relatively few, again, really technically superior talents this Juventus team. This Juventus team, when you look at it now, suddenly doesn't look as good as it has in recent years. There's a lot of holes in it. On the other hand, he is injured a lot and his form has just not been consistent really at any point, except for half a season under Manu Ciasani in the last few years. He's never made that step that we expected him to make from his early 20s into his late 20s, being an every week dominating player. Some weeks you look at him and you think, wow, you're right up there, you're incredible. And then you don't see it for the next 2 weeks. And I think that Juventus are really a little bit caught between a rock and a hard place on this, because they know that they've got a talent who has more to give than certainly most of the other forwards in their squad. But is what he's got worth what they have to spend to keep it? Because as well as anything, look where Juventus are right now. They have Dybala right now and they're struggling to get into the Champions League.
Thank goodness Newcastle is around.
Well, yeah. But does he want to play for Newcastle? You know, he wants to play
also
in the Champions League. That's the point.
You know, he's a lovely player and his left foot is one of the nicest in the game, but he's not what you need, is he, to dig out a result, you know, away at...
I think that's the issue, Max. I really do. Like, and I sort of hate reducing things to that, because that feels like such a sort of, I don't know, like the sort of old-fashioned...
So it's a keys
like,
and grave,
you know,
view,
like,
isn't
it? Yeah. For you. Yeah, but he does feel sometimes like he's a luxury player. He's so good when he's on. He's so good. He scores goals that are extraordinary and make you want to get out of your seat. And he's so enjoyable to watch when he's in that zone, but I do feel like you almost need to put him into an already strong team to get the most out of him. And I think when your team like Juventus is not at the level that it needs to be, he's not the player who stands up for you and makes a difference sometimes.
I think we've run out of time on Italy. Are you desperate to do a minute on heavy metal Torino, Nikki?
Oh, now someone asked about Torino. Ivan Juric is doing an extraordinary job. Ivan Juric, who Look, if you want to know more about it, I wrote my column on it this week, but he has given some strong statements on his love of metal music in the recent past, and his football right now at Torino is like, if Jurgen Klopp was heavy metal football in the Premier League, turn it up by several notches. It's so aggressive.
It's thrash metal. It's sort of, it's heavy, right, okay.
Well, one Italian, proper Italian analytics site described it this week as Satanism, so take it where you
want. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Thinking of mayhem and Norwegian satanic metal, that kind of thing.
Is that the one where you sort of see a video of just like the woods? It's like the woods and there's a big stage and people are just sort of wandering around aimlessly because they're absolutely fucked. And a man is on a stage in sort of all black with a sort of mask yelling, and you know, it takes all sorts. Live and let live. It's not where I'd want to be. There's a Norwegian wood that I prefer, and it is it's that song. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do the Bundesliga, we'll do France, we'll do Gianni Infantino living in Qatar, we'll do a murky story from Belgium, and we'll get to all of that. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Liga in a second. The Bundesliga, Mark. Dave says, is the Bundesliga title race back on, or am I just being optimistic?
Well, it's more on than, say, the Premier League. There's only 6 points between Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich. I think on Friday night there was quite a lot of excitement around a potential title race because Dortmund played probably their best game of the season, beat Freiburg by 5-1. It was a totally dominant performance from them quite often. And even actually at 3-1, there was the odd dodgy moment from them defensively. And you do get that with Borussia Dortmund. But they'd narrowed that gap to 3 points. And Bayern Munich have got a lot of issues at the moment with COVID. They are playing through it, unlike some teams. And they had a weakened side. You looked at their team, they were up against a Cologne side that was in form and it was away from home. And you felt like there was maybe a vulnerability that Bayern that you hadn't sort of previously seen. They won 4-0 and the game was over pretty quickly. And so that gap is at 6 points. I mean, just looking at that Bayern team, though, you had Tolisso and Rocker in central midfield, not Bayern's strongest central midfield. Joshua Kimmich and Sabitzer were the full-backs. Kimmich, of course, has played at right back, but is now seen really as a midfielder. Musiala was playing sort of nominally on the left wing. So this wasn't Bayern Munich's strongest team, and the bench, with the exception of Sané, was pretty weak as well. But they really did turn it on, actually. And I think that they responded brilliantly to the defeat last week. It was Lewandowski's 16th hat-trick in the Bundesliga, which is absurd, really. They broke the record for scoring in consecutive games. They've now scored in their last 66 Bundesliga matches. So breaking the record that was held by Bayern themselves from 2012 to 2014. So, this has happened quite often in the last few years where teams feel like they're about to put pressure on Bayern, and actually rather than sort of them crumble, they respond in the perfect way. And this was a really strong performance from them, given all the issues that they've got off the pitch at the moment.
Lewandowski kept to 300 Bundesliga goals. Actually, the Tolisso goal from that sort of Müller volleyed back heel assist was beautiful, wasn't it?
It was absolutely beautiful. And Tolisso is out of contract in the summer.
I wasn't aware of that. I'm thinking there's a super player. I mean, Tolisso is a wonderful player.
Yes, I mean, he's sort of going cheap in January if anybody wants to sign him. But it feels like he's maybe going to just get to the end of his contract. Of course, he's had his injury problems. There was, and I think there is still a fantastic player in there, but maybe teams have been put off by those injuries and the fact that he doesn't play most weeks for Bayern now. He definitely wouldn't be in their strongest 11 if they were playing a Champions League final tomorrow. He wouldn't be in the team, but I think he is somebody that when he's fit, he's definitely capable of playing at sort of Champions League level, and Bayern spent a lot of money on him. don't think it's quite worked out for him. He maybe hasn't made the progress that they were hoping, but there's certainly been moments, and that goal was absolutely fantastic, Max, as you say. And another appearance, actually, for the 16-year-old Paul Varner, who, again, we're just talking about Bayern's sort of COVID issues. You know, they are prepared and having to play school kids, essentially, or at least fill the bench.
On that, around Europe, is it different to the Premier League now? You know, you have to play and you have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think in Germany, they've got, I'm not sure of the exact translation, but it's essentially sort of normal football injuries, normal sporting injuries can't be lumped in with, any other sort of COVID issues, if you like. So, the Premier League got themselves into this mess where, AFCON counts as absentees and injuries as well. I think in La Liga, you need to have five, what they would call sort of senior players, five first team players available. And as long as you've got that, you have to kind of fill the rest of the sort of squad up with under 23s or under 21s if you need to. I know, Philippe, that Bordeaux, for instance, have had 20 odd COVID cases at times and they've just been made to carry on playing. So I think the Premier League have definitely got themselves into a situation unlike anywhere else in Europe. Yeah.
Yeah, Burnley will never play again, will they? You know, someone did tweet saying, are you even just a little bit sad you'll never be able to analyse a Burnley game as sort of pathetically as we normally do. Now, I'm looking forward to them coming back. I glossed over Erling Braut Haaland and the latest with him. And, you know, we expect him to still be there in January, but he's been saying a few things, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. And I think this really caught Dortmund by surprise. I was mentioning how well they played against Freiburg on the Friday night, and Haaland got a couple of goals, as sort of feels customary now. But then after the game, he accused Dortmund of sort of pressuring him into discussing his future and that he only wanted to concentrate on his football, which, I mean, for a player that's represented by Areola, who spends most of his time sort of talking about where he's going to take his clients. And it was only December, let's not forget, where he was openly talking about the kind of clubs that would sign Haaland in the summer. It felt a bit of a cheek, really, for the player to then come out and say that, it was wrong of Dortmund to sort of know where his head's at and whether he wants to leave and whether he will leave in the summer. Dortmund tried to play it down over the weekend and say, we just need to know at some stage. There's no real pressure on him. But it did sort of take away from what was a really good performance from them. It would be a surprise, I think, for everybody if he was still there for the start of next season. But he hasn't said he wants to go. And, it's going to be an expensive deal, even though he's got this contract clause in there because of the agent fees and everything else and the wages that he will command. There will be a market for him, but it's going to be a very expensive one. And I think Dortmund, as is a sort of the club that excellent in terms of rebuilding and just replacing their players, they want to know if they need to go out and sign a striker, which I don't think is necessarily sort of, that out of line and out of order from them.
Philippe, Belgium, Infantino, Ligue 1, where do you want to kick off? Lead us through the rest of the pod, Philippe. Come on.
Lead us into temptation. Yeah. I think we can start with, I think that the biggest news is probably what's happening in Belgium, because that's quite extraordinary, but we'll probably be able to get back to it later, I think, Max. But just to give the information, is basically there is an operation in done by Belgian police, which is called Operation Clean Hands, which started in 2017, and which is in football, investigation into fraud, into money laundering. I mean, you name it, absolutely everything. And 57 people have been indicted, and not anyone. You've got the president and the general manager and the former manager of Club Brugge, so Bart Verhage, Vincent Manart and Ivan Leko. You've got the former manager of Sporting Anderlecht. You've got the manager of KAA Ghent. When I say manager, I mean executive director, excuse me. You've got Racing Genk, actually, the former manager as well. Standard de Liège, Sporting Charleroi, Kortrijk, Mechelen, Sporting Lokeren, and also some people from the Belgian Federation, including the former president, François de Keersmaeker. All these people are suspected of very serious financial crimes and will probably end up in court, and they mean it. I mean, it is very serious business. So it's only starting as far as the public knowledge of what is going on, but it certainly is going to something which is going to keep us busy for a while. But it's quite extraordinary. 57 really important figures in Belgian football have been indicted in this operation Clean Hands.
There's no accusations of match fixing, is there? You sort of wonder if that, you know.
Yes, there is. I mean, it's so wide. It is an investigation. Doesn't mean that they have gone to their conclusion, but you've got fraud, you've got money laundering, you've got obviously what we call rétrocommission, which means back payments through and for agents and so forth. I mean, all sorts of illegal financial derring do. Which everybody knows has been the case. Belgian football has always been the Wild West. But this time, Wyatt Earp is in town and intends to clean it up.
Okay, well, let's move from that murky world to the squeaky clean world in Qatar.
Of Liga? Oh, God.
In Qatar. Of Gianni
yes.
Infantino.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
So he's moved to Qatar, which seems very sensible given that's where the World Cup's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, why not after all? It's a story that was published by the Swiss paper Blick, which usually is very Infantino friendly, and the fact that they haven't been on this particular occasion is itself revealing. The scoop actually is not theirs. I remember back in March 2021, my colleague and friend Nazim Bessel, Algerian football journalist, wrote a story about it. And at the time, nobody took it very seriously. But this time, everybody's taking it very seriously because, yes, he's basically moved. And his family as well. Two of his daughters are now at school in Doha. And obviously that throws into light and make people ask questions about his true relationship with the Emirate, because it's one thing to visit Doha regularly, which he has to do as a president of FIFA. We know that. It's another thing to live there. In which conditions? Why is he so cozy with the Qataris? Why is he always traveling in a private executive jet from Qatar Airways? Does it have an impact on the fact that, for example, when the Qataris are criticized and FIFA is put under pressure to say something about the jailing of Abdoulaye Baïs, you know, the former employee of the Supreme Committee, and FIFA basically says nothing. FIFA says nothing about the arrest and temporary imprisonment of a Norwegian film crew as well.
Just on that case that you mentioned, Philippe, and that Josimar did that investigation on, we should say that Josimar sent several questions to the Supreme Committee. A spokesperson for the World Cup organisers replied with the following: the allegations put forth regarding the conduct of the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy's legal representatives are completely false and without merit. The SC categorically denies any allegations regarding impropriety around the ethical standards of its legal team. Furthermore, we implore Josimar to provide evidence to substantiate these claims designed only to create an illusion of impropriety before publication. It carried on. The SC does not and cannot interfere or influence cases under the jurisdiction of the public prosecutor or any other relevant legal authorities. Since carrying out its own internal investigation into the alleged misbehaviour, the SC has played no part in any of the legal proceedings brought against Mr. Abais. In a statement released to The Guardian in November, the Qatar Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy said Abdullah Ibai's claim that he was targeted for taking a position on labour-related matter is a fabrication and a lie. The allegations presented by Ibai's have no credibility. The case against him is rooted in evidence of alleged manipulation and misuse of state funds and has absolutely nothing to do with personal opinions or actions on labour-related matters.
FIFA has tried to get out of it, wriggle out of it, by saying that in a way that they had said that President Infantino would spend more time. But spending more time doesn't mean moving. I mean, you're not spending more time in Australia, are you, Max? You're living in Australia.
Well, I mean, I just, you know, maybe like me, he just likes the climate, Philippe. He just, you know, that's...
Yeah, okay.
We're just, me and Gianni are just two international people. You know, I'm spending some time in the UK, some in Australia.
Citizens of the world.
That's what we are. He was...
Oh, so sweet.
Is Max briefing? Is Max sort of gently easing us into his coming move to Qatar? Is that what's happening? Is this...
That's going to be... I don't know if that tweet will be as well received. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've got some news, everybody. I'm the communications director for the Qatar World Cup. No, Nikki, we had this conversation. Philippe wasn't on the pod. I can't remember who was on, which is, we were talking about Beckham taking all the money for 150 million. And, you know, someone said, would you take 150 million pounds? And I was like, oh, because I'd really like 150 million pounds, obviously. but I just, the thought of Philippe's face, or like he would send you a WhatsApp, wouldn't he? Saying, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed. And that wouldn't be worth 150 million. You know, just...
Adieu.
Yeah, adieu. That was it. You'd never, I could never... Is you know, and I don't talk to Philippe very often, but just having the option to talk to Philippe is worth more than 150 million pounds. But 200 million, suddenly you're...
Listen, 200 million, we'll share it.
Well, it was like when I stopped taking money from gambling, and then Barry just said all he was going to do was try and get in touch with every bookie to offer me like obscene amounts of money to be the face of their campaign, just to see me squirm. Anyway, FIFA's team of the year, we talked about the women's team. The men's team is a 3-4-3, Donnarumma in goal, Diaz, Bonucci, Alaba, Kante, Jorginho, De Bruyne, with Messi, Lewandowski, Haaland and Ronaldo. So a lot of tracking back from the wide men there, Messi and Ronaldo. It's going to be tricky to win some titles, isn't it?
Wasn't there a curious choice? Because Edouard Mendy was named as goalkeeper of the year. Yes. But somehow he was not the goalkeeper in the 11 of the year.
Yeah, and Salah came third, but there's no place for Salah in that front four. So, yeah, I mean...
Well, did Salah score 47 goals across all
competitions? Very good question. And, you know, we've all had a tough year for various different reasons, but those Ronaldo goals made it all seem so sweet in the end, didn't they? Ligue 1, Philippe, give us a little rundown.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, first of all, PSG carry on their merry way. They won against Brest without Neymar, who is still injured, without Messi, who is still recovering from COVID. But I think the big news was rather at the other end of the table, another defeat for Saint-Etienne, which is catastrophic. Basically, they're last now, and an absolute drubbing of Girondins at Bordeaux by Rennes. They lost 6-0. And believe me, they could have lost by 10 or 12-0 if it hadn't been for a great performance by Benoît Costil in goal. Bordeaux is a complete basket case. They've decided to get rid of six players, including Laurent Koscielny, who was their highest earner at something like 3 million euros a year. The club was bought by somebody that, again, I can talk about off-air, Max, the former president and owner of Lille Olympique Sporting Club, Gérard Lopez, who has also left, I think, a great, great memories in Formula One circles after he was the owner of Lotus. I mean, he's something else that people like Lopez are allowed to operate in football. It's just absolutely amazing. But the result is that Bordeaux are sinking, like a stone, and I was going to say like a heavy stone, but I don't know if heavy stones actually sink more quickly than lighter stones. Maybe the shape has got something to talk about.
I think obviously like a little pebble, you know, I suspect a heavier stone would sink quicker.
I'm wondering if it's one of those, you know, when you're a child and people say, ask you, what's heavier, a kilo of feather or a kilo of lead? You know,
but what's heavier, a 1 kilo stone or a 2 kilo stone? It's the 2 kilo stone, isn't it? But I don't know at some point, I presume it gets to a weight where they all sink at the same speed. Terminal velocity through the water, who knows?
In terms of velocity, Bordeaux is sinking very fast anyway. And there are few hopes of seeing them resurfacing soon. And which means two great clubs, i.e. Bordeaux and Saint-Étienne, with wonderful historic clubs, are really in danger of being relegated this season, which would be terrible, to be absolutely honest. Apart from that, well done Rennes, who had a little bit of a tricky moment, but are back in the European place race, and a team that I really advise people to watch if they want to see some lovely football. And I'm really happy for Bruno Genesio, who was so criticized when he was at Lyon, and who is doing great work with them. And to finish, great work again by a manager, but that's no surprise, it's Christophe Galtier at OGC Nice. They're now second in the league. They don't necessarily have the greatest squad, but he's a top manager, and they're now in second place, ahead of Marseille, who didn't manage to beat LOSC despite being 11-10 for something like 60 minutes. So there you go. This is Ligue 1 for you.
Following on from that, Alex says, is Mark Langdon doing veganuary? I think I already know the answer.
No, I'm not. I mean, January is the most miserable month of them all. I don't see why people make themselves more miserable by sort of taking away some of life's pleasures like meat and alcohol. That doesn't make any sense.
James says, my wife has continuously been advised, my opinion, that unsalted butter, regardless of any recipe instruction, is the devil's creation and should not be used. Thoughts?
I agree with that. I always use salted butter. Every recipe is better with a bit of salt in it. Every recipe.
No. I was going to say absolutely, including in pastry and cakes, yeah, and puddings. Use salted butter.
Yes, but I mean, I want the answer from the butter wizard. I'm not interested in these. I'm not interested in these amateurs,
sorry,
frankly.
I think that Philippe and Nikki have got it absolutely spot on. I know that there's a lot of recipes, particularly in sort of pastries and where they and baking, where they do advise, the recipe often says it's an unsalted butter, but no, just ignore it.
There we are. What's your current butter of choice? Kerrygold, what are you on?
At the moment, we've gone for something slightly healthier, actually. We're on sort of like just, yeah, like Anchor and Clover and stuff like, okay, that. But I have been on some really creamy ones sort of in the past.
Okay. Yeah. Pretty halcyon solid years.
The French, I mean, some of the French butters are sort of, the French salted butters are the ones to go for. But, you know, you have to limit, even I would limit my intake of that because, you know, you've got to.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. And that'll do for today's podcast. Nikki, thanks so much.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
We're back on Thursday.
This is The Guardian.